ordinary taxpayers forced to subsidize corporate criminals? Contact USPIRG at USPIRG.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City, Community Radio. Streaming online at www.kkfi.org.
Good evening. Good evening, this is Michelle Pond, and you're listening to Art Speak Radio. And with the studio, with me in the studio for my first segment is Laura Vogt from the National World War I Museum. Laura is the Curator of Education at the National World War I Museum at Liberty Memorial. When she is not engaging audiences on topics relating to the First World War, she can be found behind the scenes planning programs and creating educational materials both online and on-site regarding the museum and its exhibitions. Vogt is a graduate of the University of Missouri, where she completed her master's in curriculum and instruction with a specialty in educational technology, a bachelor's in history, and a bachelor's in secondary social sciences education. Prior to joining the National World War I Museum, she was a classroom teacher and developed curricula at schools in the U.S., Singapore, and Turkey. Welcome, Laura. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
And you've had a busy year, starting probably about last August.
It was actually June 28th was the start of a really busy time for us, the centennial of the First World War. That is going really from June of 2014 through 2019 as we look at the effects of the peace treaty and how that impacts our present day as well.
And how far in advance did the planning for the centennial celebration begin?
Oh, my goodness. Since I joined the museum, truly, it's been in the works for quite some time. And really, it's been in the works since 1919, when the first idea of this memorial came to Kansas Cityans, when they came together because they wanted to create a memorial for those who lived through and those who died during the World War. I think this has really been a community that has been committed to remembrance and commemoration of the World War and really the events that have happened since that point in time.
So when the planning began, was there a theme or message that sort of came about right away?
Yeah, we actually have set, for each of the years, we have set some guiding questions and themes. So for example, 2014, It's really why did the war begin? In 2015, the theme is escalation and how does the world respond? And then we have continuing themes and guiding questions that lead us through the rest of the years.
Wow, that's interesting. And now this wonderful collaboration that's taken place is continuing to take place among a number of the different arts organizations.
Oh, it's so much fun.
And how did that come about?
Absolutely. We actually started that conversation over 2 years ago, I would say, and really with some of our key cultural institutions here in Kansas City. At the National World War I Museum, we had a meeting with our friends at the Nelson Atkins Museum, specifically curator Jan Schall, also from the Lyric Opera, Deborah Sandler, folks from the Kansas City Ballet and then also from the Kansas City Symphony. It was really a wonderful opportunity for us to collaborate and have some good conversation about opportunities to showcase the world-class artistry of Kansas City and at the same time to reflect on how the World War not only changes history and sets the foundation for really the 20th and the 21st centuries, but it really changes art and it changes music. And when you listen to Jan and Deborah and Michael Stern talk about this, I mean, just some of the best professionals in their field, and we are lucky enough to have them here in Kansas City, you can't help but be moved and understand how this one historic event changes everything as we know it.
Well, as it changes people's life, right? It changes their reactions, and so it changes a lot of things, but it changes all of the art forms.
Absolutely. I mean, we've talked about the fact that arts in general, they really have the capacity to change the world. They inspire hope. They transcend reality that far too often encompasses a lot of misery. And it is our opportunity to look at those events that some of the individuals at the time, we actually have an exhibition up now by Renifer, and he is, we have the opportunity to look at how he is kind of translating his experiences in the trenches as a poilu, and experience that as he kind of is sharing that with his children. We also have an exhibition that's going down in, actually this weekend, it's the last weekend that it's up, called War and Art, about how folks are protecting their art. I say folks, it's actually not just folks. That's a little too colloquial. It's Italians. It's how the Italians are actually protecting their art. It was an exhibition that was curated out of an organization in Rome. It's a way to truly bring history alive.
So as the discussions went on, mm-hmm. and these groups began to talk, was each group able to come back to the museum representatives and say what they wanted to do? Or how did that work? How did the pieces actually get chosen?
Great question. The coming together occurred really with having these great minds around the table and being creative with what we thought was possible, you know, within each institution, bringing to light conversations of what they thought would best reflect within their sector, just this change, and would really enable us to commemorate as a present generation. So, for example, the Lyric Opera this weekend is beginning a presentation of the Pulitzer Prize-winning opera Silent Night, which looks at the events of the Christmas Truce of 2014. And so Deborah was talking about that. Jeffrey Bentley was discussing, there's a really interesting ballet called The Green Table, and so brought that into the conversation. I think you'll be talking to Jan Schall shortly, and she can share really about all the amazing pieces that are within the Nelson Atkins existing collection that she was able to bring together across different sectors to really show this. And again, Michael Stern, when you listen to him talk about the Rite of Spring, I mean, you can't help but be moved. So really, it was just for us to listen and learn about what would be a great opportunity for each of these amazing folks to be bringing to the table, and just to see how we might be able to assist in sharing that message and talking about it. But really, it was the opportunity to talk about a way to craft situations throughout Kansas City where people could commemorate through the arts, where they could go into the Kauffman Center, they could go into the Nelson, and hopefully be moved and be changed in I think what is the first of its kind collaboration in the nation, and certainly, you know, Kansas City is leading the nation in commemoration of the First World War, as you're well aware. We were just named the nation's monument to World War I. Mm-hmm. So again, it's right. Kansas City has been doing this since 1919, and it's where the community continues to come together.
And of course, the museum is a center.
Absolutely, it's been a center, and I think a center for commemoration and for community involvement and for learning. You know, that is our mission. It is to really inspire thought, dialogue, and learning about the First World War. And there's no better way to do that than really working with our world class institutions that are here with us as well.
And actually, at the museum, you do use the arts as a vehicle for teaching about the war. On a regular basis. I mean, that's a standard part.
Oh, absolutely. We've got
the museum.
Yes, definitely. We have some rotating exhibitions. I think I mentioned Renifer and War and Art. We have another wonderful exhibition coming up about likely the most influential political cartoonist of the First World War, Louis Rademacher. I hope I said that correctly. My Dutch is not that good. But it's a great insight into what people were feeling, and it's an easy way to really see what some of those experiences were like. And then there's art, obviously, all throughout the main gallery as well. You've got these beautiful posters and sheet music covers, right? Norman Rockwell actually does the sheet music cover for Over There. You've got James Montgomery Flagg and his quintessential We Want You poster that comes out of World War I. You have these riveting images of women and propaganda as well that just help transport you back into that mindset. And some of them are just really beautiful. Just some beautiful, beautiful pieces as well. That's inside the main gallery. And up in Memory Hall, we have what was at one point in time the world's largest oil painting, the Pantheon de la Guerre, which is one of my favorite pieces at the museum.
And you also have the sound booths?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Where you can listen to
music.
Poetry, music.
You're right. Art is certainly not limited to the visual arts. We've got poetry. We've got, actually, it's the 100th anniversary of John McCrae's In Flanders Fields poem. That's coming up here in 2015. You can hear that. You can hear some of the great songs of the World War I era.
Over there?
Over there, yes.
Over there at the museum, you can hear over there?
Absolutely.
I thought so. And also, the entryway could be considered a piece of art, yes?
It's funny. Actually, one of our staff members had family in, and they asked me who did the installation of the poppy field, thinking that it was truly an art piece and would have been named. It is not named per se. It is part of the new construction that was done in 2006 with our museum staff, including our senior curator, Doran Cart, and our archivist, Jonathan Casey, and the incredible Ralph Applebaum and Associates. They are the museum building group. That's really not the right way to call it. But they are, they're phenomenal. They're the same group that has done the U.S. Holocaust Museum, and they came up with a stunning entryway that everyone in Kansas City is, I think, quite pleased with, and it's a notable space.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Funding for KKFI provided by the Weekly Pyramid All Souls UU Church. Each Sunday at 10 a.m., the forum will feature a discussion on community issues. All Souls UU Church is at 4501 Walnut Street, one block east of Main. in Kansas City. More information is at allsoulskc.org.
This is Richard Mabian, and I'm president of the NAACP in Kansas City, Kansas, and I wanted to announce that we're hosting a candidate forum Saturday, February 21st, at 21 North 12th Street in Kansas City, Kansas, and the time will be at 4 p.m. This message of public service of 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
And welcome back to Art Speak Radio. We're talking about Casey Arts Remembers the Great War. And my first guest tonight is Laura Vogt from the National World War One Museum. And Laura, I wanted to go back to the entryway a little bit and just say that I know when I go to the museum and I stand on that bridge, I feel like I'm looking down on an impressionist painting.
That's a beautiful way to describe that. When I work with individuals and in introducing the space, we like it if people come in and kind of think if that had once been a farm field, and you can see the ductwork, you can see what may have kind of been the effect, as if thousands of men had tromped across, and if trenches had been dug and barbed wire put across it. There's really just this barrenness, and in that barrenness we have 9,000 poppy blooms, each of them representing 1,000 combatants that died in the war. And they recently discovered with some research that it was the nitrates of the ammunition, but also the nitrates of the decomposing bodies, that made it really the perfect soil composition for poppies to flourish. And it's really how the image of the poppy became the symbol of veterans here in the United States, but around the globe, made most popular by John McCrae's poem In Flanders Fields.
Yes. Now there already have been a number of events that have taken place. I know, as a matter of fact, I was fortunate to go to one of the latest ones, and that was an Iliad by Kansas City Repertory Theater.
Right? Wasn't that fantastic?
Yes, it was.
There have been some tremendous presentations that have occurred here in Kansas City in 2014. We worked with the Harriman Jewel Series and helped commission a new piece by Kronos Quartet that was presented at the Kauffman Center. There's a beautiful organ concert by Jan Krabel with the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. Kansas City Symphony has just their work at the celebration at the station, along with several other concerts. They still have one more coming up in May. If people want more information, they should go to www.kcsymphony.org. That's just been tremendously moving. I know both Jan and I were able to catch Rites of Spring. It was tremendous. The Friends of Chamber Music, we had an amazing panel conversation with their quartet, Metropolitan Ensemble Theater. It's been unbelievable to be able to work with all of these groups this year. It's really been a highlight, both for me personally, but I would say for our institution, it's been a phenomenal year, and we're looking forward to continuing those partnerships and continuing our arts offerings throughout the centennial.
That's great. And so, you know, you were talking before, so actually the centennial will run through 1918?
Correct. It will run through 2019.
Yeah, 1918.
I do that all the 2018. Time. Every, at least once a week. I'm 100 years off. we've got actually this summer, talking about other things coming up, this summer we have a tremendous art exhibition. I believe it's the largest export of Australian art. It's called A Centenary of Australian War Art, and that will be coming to the museum July 10th and will stay up for about 5 months. So we are continuing with these art partnerships with within Kansas City, but also reaching outside of the nation as well.
Wow, that's great. Also, very good sort of cross, my athletic, I almost said cross training, cross promoting as far as all of the partners involved promoting all of the other events that have been going on.
Absolutely. I think it's a testament to, again, it's a testament to our other institutions. I think we have a great deal of, get a great deal of enjoyment out of working together as well. It improves our ability to reach audiences when we get the opportunity to work together. And sometimes it's actually such fun, it doesn't really feel like work. It's almost like play. But it is...
Almost
like play. but it is. It's really... It's an opportunity for us to just... you know, it's an opportunity to highlight the world-class institutions and artistry here in Kansas City in a global commemoration effort. And it's, I don't know that you could find this in any other city in the United States. I really think, and I think it's something about Kansas City. I mean, truly, this is the city that came together to make this happen in 1919. As a transplant here to Kansas City, I have to admit it doesn't seem it doesn't surprise me that again Kansas Cityans want to come back together and lead that global commemoration effort. It's a pleasure to be here. And if anyone who's listening has gone to any of these events, I think they would wholeheartedly agree about what a pleasure it is to be a part of these programs.
And one other interesting thing for this part of the centennial is the online exhibit of the regarding the Christmas truce.
Absolutely. Thank you. So the Christmas truce, again, find out more information about that. Along with many of these other events, if you go to our website, www.theworldwar.org, our Christmas Truce online exhibition looks at the true events that lead to the one piece that is really called during this during the wartime, and it happens around the holidays. If you follow the historic artifacts, it really starts in some spots along the Western Front, December 24th, Christmas Eve, and goes through a couple of the days outside of the first part of the new year. It is these impromptu pieces that happen primarily between the British and the Germans, and they're it's this one opportunity in the most inhumane conditions where everyday men show the best of humanity, where they're really living out peace on earth and goodwill to men, the truest of the Christmas spirit. And we have the opportunity to share that in one of, actually, if you've watched the video, there we actually have, it's a Trench record player, and it is playing a record from the era. Uh-huh. It's playing Silent Night, and so that's the background. That's the background music for the images that you see after listening to our speaker.
And don't they start to sing? Or
they did.
That's.
They did. They actually, no, it's in the letters. In the letters, you can actually read that there was singing and that there was an exchange of cigarettes and chocolate. We just actually had a great event at the museum about chocolate and whiskey. Somewhat in line with that. Again, if you want more information about such events, you should check out our website. But it's true. Those events are true. Now, there's been an ad, a British grocery store ad, that may be taking some artistic license. We like to leave the artistic license to the arts institutions. We like to stick within the realm of historic artifact and evidence, but there is a great deal of evidence that this occurred. There's some beautiful letters that are well worth reading, over 120 of them. So you can read through if anyone is heading out to the Silent Night Opera this week, or I believe it runs through March 1st, they should certainly check out the online exhibition, see some of our artifacts, see and read the words of the men who were there. It really is a moving piece. It was really a moving piece to work on.
And there's also some critical documents, too. I mean, like some essays.
There are. There's an essay by Stanley Weintraub, who wrote the book Silent Night. It is the book about the Christmas truce. He's actually going to be in town tomorrow evening for a conversation with our president and CEO, Dr. Matthew Naylor, and Deborah Sandler, who I believe is going to be on here shortly as well, along with the Pulitzer Prize winners, Campbell and Putz. Yes. That will be tomorrow. So he was kind enough to write an essay, but is even kinder to come and speak about his book. I think he'll be reading some portions of that. Stanley wrote an essay. Our senior curator, Doran Cart, wrote an essay. Mike Scheel. We have four great essays, a video that kind of explains in brief what it is about, and then an opportunity to look through different artifacts and see the visuals, like the Princess Mary box. It was actually a box that was sent to men who were serving on the front. Letters, handkerchiefs, photographs. We've actually got some bottles in there too. I believe that goes along with one of the letters that talks about whiskey.
So, Laura, what kind of feedback in general are you getting on this collaboration that's been taking place and the way the centennial's being marked here in Kansas City?
Michelle, I am receiving feedback not only from our local community, but from the national community and the international community about the events that are occurring here in Kansas City, and from our counterparts around the globe. They have been impressed with the partnerships and the collaborations. They are asking for video links online. That is wonderful to hear, I think, about from an institutional perspective, but also from a Kansas Cityan's perspective. And it's been wonderful to watch our audience be moved by the art and by the conversations. People have been very pleased with the partnerships and have enjoyed immensely these different presentations and programs. And we're looking forward to continuing this line of offering.
And how, you talked about continuing these types of partnerships in the future. Anything
I can tell you yet?
Just in general.
Just in general, but keep your eyes peeled for other new programs that are coming. There are many ways that the First World War changes theater, the visual arts, music, and there are tremendous partners here in Kansas City for us to continue working with and for us to be building new programs with.
Any last words for our audience? Anything that you want to mention The website, maybe at least one more time?
Absolutely. Our website is www.theworldwar.org. And really, it's I need to say thank you to our not only our team at the National World War I Museum, our volunteers and our staff who make these events happen, but also to our partners at the cultural institutions in Kansas City. It has been a pleasure to partner with them this year, and we're looking forward to the next 4 years of programming.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. And I'd like to thank Laura Vogt from the National World War I Museum, and in the next segment, Jan Schell from the Nelson Atkins Museum will be joining us.
Support for 90.1 FM provided by Folk Alliance Music Fair Art Gallery. Open from Thursday, February 19th through Sunday, February 22nd in the Sheraton Crown Center Hotel. Original art will be available for purchase from music-related artists including Tim Kerr, Daniel Johnston, Sam Baker, Bob Walkenhorst, and many more. Special gallery music events include the Royal Grit All-Stars on Friday, February 20th, and Spoken Word on Saturday, February 21st. For more information, folk.org.
The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's speech on America's chief moral dilemma from May of 1967 on the Thursday night special at 7 p.m. right after the Heartland Labor Forum.
And welcome back to Art Speak Radio. I'm Michelle Pond, and now joining me is Jan Schell from the Nelson Atkins Museum. Jan is the Sanders Soslin Curator of Modern Art, and she joined the Nelson Atkins in 1996. She holds a doctorate in art history from the University of Texas at Austin and a master's degree in art history from Washington University in St. Louis. In 2000, Schell organized the National Endowment for the Arts Millennium Projects exhibition, Tempus Fugit, Time Flies, and produced both its accompanying catalog and award-winning website. She curated Roxy Payne, Skumix, and Dendroids, and the accompanying catalog, Magnificent Gifts for the 75th, Kiki Smith Constellation, Bonjour Picasso, and Inventing the Shuttlecocks. Schell oversaw the renovation and reinstallation of the museum's Donald J. Hall Sculpture Park and developed and implemented both the program and installation of the Modern Contemporary Collection in the expanded museum. She's a former art history instructor at the University of Florida Gainesville, and her research has been supported by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts, the German Academic Exchange Service, and the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. Thanks so much, Jan, for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Michelle. It's good to be here.
So let's pick up the story now as far as your involvement. As Laura told us earlier, it sounds like you were kind of right in on the ground floor.
We were. We had actually been discussing options about how we might at the Nelson Atkins observe the centennial, but they were pretty much rough-edged conversations. And then the World War I Museum brought us all together, as Laura has discussed. And around the table, we really talked about what might be possible, what definitely we could do, what kinds of things would fit into our time frame, how we might really build on the strengths of each other and make this a full collaboration citywide. And it has been an unbelievable experience, really one of the great experiences of my career, to be working so collaboratively with all of the other arts organizations in the city, and all centered around the nucleus, as I see it, which is the National World War I Museum.
And so how did the World War I and the rise of modernism come about? How was that chosen as your topic?
Well, the question was, first of all, we normally plan 5 to 7, sometimes even 10 years out on a major or big exhibition that would be a featured exhibition in our large galleries. And this came up
really just 2 years out, and we weren't sure we would be able to do anything in that short of time. And then it seemed like what we could do would be to take advantage of our extraordinary collection at the Nelson Atkins and go cross departments, with the modern department, the American department, the photography department, drawing on the prints and drawings collection, and all together really create an exhibition that would tell this story. And that's where we started, and we had lots of conversations around the table, both at the museum and at the World War One Museum with our colleagues across the community, and this just seemed to be the way to tell it. Our emphasis, obviously, is on the art. The World War One Museum emphasizes the history and tells that story, but what we can tell through our collections at the museum is what was happening in the art world in the years preceding the war, during the war, and after the war, because the situation politically and historically throughout Europe at that moment was obviously affecting the artists as well, and they were responding to socio-political, philosophical, scientific innovations and all of those things that became, on one hand, very exciting. I mean, this was a tremendous moment of innovation and change in world culture, but also became sort of threatening and frightening to people and upsetting to people. For instance, when the agricultural economy, which had been in place really since the beginning of time, gave way to the Industrial Revolution, it was terribly unsettling to people in all the nations, in industrialized nations, because it meant that the nicely knit, close communities in farmsteads and in smaller communities around the Western world, suddenly there were jobs in the cities, working in factories, and that meant that young people went off to the cities, breaking their families up. And in the cities, they felt to some degree alienated, alone, were working in factories which were, you know, be here at this time, work all day long, sometimes work beyond the hours that you're supposed to work, just keep working, not being paid well, and so forth. And so you have a foment that's really happening here of uncertainty. And I think of it as a kind of identity crisis. And out of that identity crisis comes the art.
And one thing I wanted to ask you about the exhibit in general is it, and I think actually Laura might have mentioned this, it is actually Nelson Atkins pieces that belong to the Nelson Atkins and then some pieces on loan from the World War One Museum, but really not from anywhere else.
Well, we do have some things from elsewhere as well.
Oh, we do?
Yes, okay. We do, but we have about 60 works of art on view in the exhibition. And as you say, most of them are from our collection. We borrowed a very important painting by Vasily Kandinsky from the Guggenheim Museum in New York City, a very key painting because it was painted in between 1909 and 1910, that is in the pre-war era, and it is reflective of Kandinsky's absolute belief that the world was on the brink of a new spiritual era, and that optimism and hopefulness about what this foment that I've been mentioning would lead to was tremendously positive, and always anticipating that the world was going to change for some greater good and become a better place and a spiritually aligned place. And then the irony, of course, of that is that 4 years later, the war broke out. We also were able to borrow two works from the World War One Museum. We borrowed a fantastic poster called The Greatest Mother in the World, which is a very, very moving piece. And it is an image of a Red Cross nurse holding, cradling in her arms, the wounded body of a veteran, or of a soldier, I should say. And it's, in a sense, what she has become is the surrogate mother for all those mothers around the world who had given their sons up to this war. So very powerful piece, and in conjunction with a painting that we have from the collection, makes that statement very clear. We also borrowed from the World War One Museum a photograph, an aerial photograph, of Verdun. And Verdun was one of the great and longest-lasting entrenchments of the war, where So many people lost their lives, so many horrible conditions, and just on and on and slogging and forward. It was devastating. And to look at this aerial photograph, what you see are what anybody that didn't know might think were little streams running through the landscape, and might think it was a very hilly landscape, and partly it was. But what it really is revealing is the kind of mucky water and melted snow that filled the trenches and that the soldiers had to stand in up to their knees and sometimes to their hips in this cold, freezing world during the winter, dealing with foot rot and lice and fleas and disease and all kinds of horrors in those trenches. And then the other thing that you see are pockmarks from all of the bombs going off and the artillery that was exploding throughout the landscape. So just to see this black and white photograph is interesting, but to remember and realize what you are looking at is quite devastating. So that is those two were very important. And then we borrowed a chair, a single chair from a private donor, which we are so glad to have, because there are three vignette moments throughout the exhibition that let us experience what domestic life was like at that moment, outside of the world of the fine art that's hanging on museum walls. But the chairs, the utensils, the hairs and hairbrushes and combs and dresser sets, yes, and all of those wonderful things that we live with. And that's what other people were doing while the soldiers were doing what they were doing.
My mom actually had a similar sort of mirror brush and comb set, not in gold, but in sterling silver.
Mm-hmm.
But it looked familiar. The comb was the same kind of bone type comb. And
Tortoise shell.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, and so that kind of made my heart beat a little faster when I saw that.
It's very poignant when you see images of war directly adjacent to life back home.
Yeah. And, what I thought was interesting in having so many of the Nelson's own pieces in this exhibit is that you get to see them in another context. Like you're walking and you look and you say, oh, I know that, I've seen that. And then you read the story behind it as it pertains to this exhibit.
You are so right, and that was one of the goals of this exhibition, was to recontextualize works that everybody's familiar with. But when you see them in a kind of neutral zone, you walk into a gallery and you see these works on the walls, you are looking at them as works of art, which they are, but you're not necessarily seeing the real depth of the culture that they came out of. Of course, we allude to those things and we talk about it to some degree in all of our labels and our text panels in the galleries. But to see, cheek by jowl, so to speak, all of these works that, and to realize that they were part of a whole movement that was underway, conversations that were happening among the artists literally and also just by distance with looking at each other's art and being aware of what was going on, what they were wrestling with, what they hoped for, what the reality of their lives was about. Some of the artists, of course, served in the war. Some of them died in the war.
Yes.
Some of them...
and actually, that's another portion of the exhibit, that there are about six mm-hmm. artists who kind of are featured, or whose stories are featured. You actually pull them out and tell their whole story, but then you can follow it through the exhibit.
Right, and that's a very important part of our interpretive plan for the exhibition, that we have, of course, the exhibition of the works of art themselves. And then on some of the, as you say, on six of the labels, we called out with just a photograph of the artist and a call out uh-huh. to visit further in the North Corridor, where those panels reveal the deeper stories of those six artists. Some of whom were, one who was in the war, who in fact died in the war, died at Verdun, mm-hmm. as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Claude Monet, whose son and stepson were both in the war, and Monet was working at his studio in Giverny, which when the Western Front was at its closest was just 60 miles away from Giverny, where he was working on the Water Lily series, that most peaceful, beautiful, bucolic, lovely suite of paintings working on those while he could probably hear artillery with the wind in the right direction. Also, he was in conversation with correspondence with Georges Clemenceau, who was the leader of the French forces during the war, who went on to become the president of France, and they were very good friends. And so they kept up a correspondence, and at one point, probably several points, Clemenceau said, you know, you need to get out of Giverny. You need to go to Paris. Get out of there. It's basically, it's coming too close to you. And Monet said something like, I'm staying here. They'll have to kill me in front of my life's work. Mm. And he stayed, and he continued to paint. And then, I mean, this is one of the beautiful parts of the final part of the exhibition, the after-the-war moment when Monet ended up with this beautiful suite of water lilies, which he then gave to the French nation as a gift from him in the name of peace.
And what a great place to stop. We'll take a short break again, and we will be right back.
KKFI's live broadcast from the KKFI stage at the 2015 Folk Alliance Conference begins Wednesday night at 8 with Bob and Diana Sukiel. Ruddy Swain, Calvin Arsenia, and the Expassionates follow in order. Tune in for this special live broadcast Wednesday night at 8.
Race relations in the LGBT community on the 10th Voice, Saturday afternoon at 1.
And welcome back. I'm Michelle Pond, and my guest this segment is Jan Shull, talking about the exhibit World War One and the Rise of Modernism. And Jan, we were talking about the half dozen artists that are kind of featured in this exhibit, that people can read their story, as you said, I think on the north wall, but they can also follow their works through the exhibit with a little marking of their picture and things. And how did you choose all of those people to be represented?
Yes. We could have told the individual stories of any of those artists, but we chose six. It's a nice number that is just enough, but not too much, to really call out and go into depth with our information about their personal lives and how they were impacted. Another one was Käthe Kollwitz,
yes,
on the German side, and she lost a son in the war and was devastated by that. And when she talked about it, she said, you know, it was as if the umbilical cord had been cut twice. Once.
Go ahead.
Käthe Kollwitz said it was as if the umbilical cord had been cut twice, once at the birth of her son and the second time at his death.
Well, and I thought it was an interesting grouping, because you chose really different things that happened to each person. As far as there was one artist who died of, he and his wife died of influenza.
That's right. That was Egon Schiele, and he served in the war from the Austrian side, and left the war earlier, and then he and his wife, who was pregnant, all died just short of the armistice. The irony, you know, you can't miss the irony of something like that.
And what are some of the things that, what are some of the other points that you wanted people to take away from this exhibit?
Well, I was hoping, we were hoping that people would, A, as you mentioned, see this whole experience of modern art in a new way. I think often modern art is off-putting to people. They don't understand what's going on. It's not realistic in the traditional sense, and so sometimes it's hard for people to get their arms around it. But I think given a context like this, it really allows people to live into the work and to experience the personal life of the artist, as well as the work that was created by that artist. Other things that we hope that they would gather from this was the intimate relationship between art and culture, that art doesn't exist in a vacuum, that art comes out of a culture and is a response to experiences that people have who are living in that culture, that there was an exchange that was always ongoing between all of the artists from the various countries that were in this war against one another. You know, Austrian artists, French artists, German artists, Russian artists.
Some who knew each other?
Yes, people who knew each other and certainly knew each other's work and as artists. And the idea that these so-called rational countries, I mean, everybody thought this is a civilized world. These countries are all civilized. The boundaries between the countries were very fluid. People went back and forth. The Germans went to Paris. The Austrians went to Munich, to Berlin. Americans came over, went to Munich, Berlin. And it was very fluid. People were moving all around, and the internationalism of the art world was predominant. And then to suddenly have this war break out that prohibited the transference of people across borders, literally, but also figuratively speaking, was such a shock, was such an outrageous notion that this could happen in Europe.
And there were also some artists whose work changed after their experience in the war, correct?
Yes, to some degree that's true. I mean, artists were working in certain ways before the war, and then during the war things changed, and then after the war things changed again, because culture changed, their lives changed, the ability that they had to travel changed, their connections with other people changed. But also, like any art, it continues to evolve. It's always changing, and an artist is never going to stand still and just say, oh, now I've done that, that's it. I'm done with everything. I'll just paint the same thing now for the rest of my life. Artists are always looking at the world with fresh eyes and fresh minds and fresh hearts. And they're always responding to what they are living and the conversations they're having, the books they're reading, the music they're listening to, the ideas that are circulating, the scientific notions that are coming to them, whether in depth or in just kind of a brief overview. But they're getting such a huge picture, like all of us do. We're living, and then we respond to life. And so what you paint before the war cannot be the same as what you paint after the war, because you have been changed. The world has been changed.
And what were the a couple of the larger changes just as far as movements, artistic movements?
Well, before the war, the dominant movements were expressionism and cubism. And expressionism was what you might expect, all about expressing through color and line and shape and form and texture inner emotions. Even if you're looking at something and depicting something, it's very emotional. Cubism, on the other hand, was primarily focused on ideas about science, things that were being revealed about space and time. Not that they understood what Einstein had written in the theory of relativity, but they certainly were aware of the general discussion about these things and the fact that we experience life in moments of time. And to, for instance, the cubists, the idea of taking a still life, what does that mean? It means things just arranged on a table that are absolutely static and still. Well, the cubists said, that's not the way it is. When you're sitting around a table like we are here, and if you were having a drink or if you were smoking a cigarette or eating a pastry or whatever, or reading the newspaper or talking about a book, you would be very active. And their goal was to capture the sense of life in motion. And so the idea that you were using the term still life, or in French it would be nature morte, dead nature. And of course, it's anything but dead. It's everything is alive and moving and faster in that world. Then things change during the war. First of all, a lot of the artists can't be making art anymore, or they're prohibited. Kandinsky had to go back to Russia, for instance, and people had to go back to the United States if they were working elsewhere once the United States got involved. And then after the war, that horrible nightmare was over. There was great jubilation, but there was also a lot of analysis. One of the things that happened, I haven't talked about this, but one of the things that happened during the war and continued after was an investigation of irrationalism. In other words, the culture had been priding itself on being so rational and orderly, and suddenly it was disorder and irrationalism. And so the Dada artists actually, many people came from all of the nations and ended up in Zurich, in Switzerland, which was neutral. And there they really set about mocking and mourning what was happening in the war. And they acted in absurd ways, and they made art in absurd ways, and they made nonsense poems. And all of that was about mocking the absurdity of the notion that the world could be at war. And then after the war, the surrealists picked up on that notion of irrationality, and their approach was not to just engage in antics, but to really try to figure out, where did this come from? And they had Freud for their guide on that. And Freud said, you know, we may present as very rational beings on the surface, but underneath we have an entirely different experience of irrational fears, anger, all kinds of things that we wish we could keep under control, but sometimes they just bubble up and explode. And so those things are the things of dreams, nightmares. And the surrealists then continued to explore that realm of the unconscious and the irrational realm in their art, with kind of eerie and haunting dreamscapes, vacant and disturbed.
And what did you learn or take away from this exhibit? Now, the exhibit runs through July 19th.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to make that clear, and people can get more information about it at nelson-atkins.org.
Nelson-atkins.org.
Mm-hmm.
What did I get out of it? Well, I've been a professor of art history for 12 years, a curator for 18 years, and my focus has been on really all modern and contemporary, but my own dissertation was on a German subject, rhythm and art in Germany, 1900 to 1930.
Ah.
So it was for me an opportunity to really delve into a subject that I know quite well and to learn more about it and to see in a very visceral way. It was very, very personal for me to work on this exhibition and to compile and arrange the works that have so much to say to us on this subject of what is art, what is modernism, and how did the war affect it all.
And your thoughts on the collaboration?
Oh, fantastic. It was just a brilliant experience to work with Laura and Deborah and all of our other cohorts in this project to make something happen that's bigger than any one of us, something that will, I think, live on as an exemplar of what's possible among the arts community. We're all in this. We live in a culture that's multidimensional, and they lived in a culture that was multidimensional. And the fact that we can try to recapture some of that and bring it alive for now has been a remarkable experience.
And are there any upcoming things that you'd like to talk about?
Oh, you got me off guard on that one. Let's see. I think I'm unprepared to talk about exactly what's coming up. We always have new things going on at the Nelson Atkins,
yes.
As you know. Just stay tuned.
Well, let me take a little sidebar then. There is also another exhibit up at the Nelson, the American Soldier Photographs.
Ab, I'm so glad you brought that up. It reminded me of something very important that's concurrent. When you said coming up, I thought you meant in the future. But the Soldiers exhibition is on view also right now in our photography galleries in the Block building. And it is a very different kind of exhibition than World War I and the Rise of Modernism. It's all photography, but it also has an autobiographical quality, so that people are writing their own stories or telling stories. And it is all of the wars from the Revolutionary War through the Indian Wars and the Civil War and the World War I and World War II and the Korean War and all the way through Afghanistan and Iraq. And it's very powerful, very moving.
Yes, and it's more focused on photographs that may have been taken as news photographs but have a very much an artistic quality.
There are many different points of view with that exhibition. Some are indeed news photographs that are really works of art at the same time. Some are photographs that people took while they were there, even a video. So there are all kinds of different approaches. And then I think the words that people have written, that the artists have written, that people who were there have written, and we have a space for people to offer their own experiences, yes, which is very, very moving.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, Jan, thank you so much. And again, it's World War I and the Rise of Modernism through July 19th. And the website one more time?
Nelson-Atkins.org.
All right. And we're going to take a short break with some music. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Thanks, Michelle.
And this is Art Speak Radio. I'm Michelle Pond, and you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. And for our third segment, my guest is Deborah Sandler, General Director and CEO of Lyric Opera of Kansas City. She joined the company in 2012. Previously, Ms. Sandler served as General Director of Kentucky Opera and Opera Festival of New Jersey. She began her career as General Manager of the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia. During her tenures as General Director in Princeton, New Jersey and Louisville, Kentucky, Ms. Sandler doubled the budget of each institution and created increased organizational capacity by growing audience, increasing contributions, and raising the visibility of each organization through artistic initiatives and the creation of dynamic education and audience development programs. She has a strong commitment to artistic excellence, growth, and deepening community connections through programs which create value and relevance for the community served. Originally from Philadelphia, she's a graduate of Temple University with a degree in music. She earned a Master's of Arts degree in musicology from New York University, completing all of her doctoral coursework. She has also studied at the Mandel Center for Nonprofits at Case Western Reserve and at the Fundraising School at Indiana University. Thank you, Deborah, for joining us. I know that you are that the company is in dress rehearsal.
Yes, ma'am. As we speak.
And so I know you're going to be running running over there, and so thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, it caught my eye in your biography about the community connections and creating value and relevance for the communities. And now here you are in as part of this collaboration for the centennial of the World War One of World War One. So tell us a little bit about your part. Again, as Laura had mentioned, as with Jan, you seem to be right in on the ground floor of this.
Absolutely. I arrived in Kansas City on July 1st, 2012. That was my first day of work. And I think it was sometime within the first month that we had a meeting and we talked about the notion of a community collaboration where different arts groups in their own way commemorated the centennial of World War One. And my lovely colleagues here were sitting at the table with me, and we went through a whole bunch of different conversations and explored a number of different options. It's very interesting because I have received a couple of questions just during the last week, and the question was, well, why didn't you do this opera at Christmas at Silent Night? Why are you doing it now? Well, you know, I have a practical answer and I have a more theoretical answer. I guess they're both practical. The production was not available at Christmas, so that was one problem. But when we all got together, we fairly quickly established the time frame of the commemoration, or at least the initial footprint of the commemoration would take place between January and March. And so we fit perfectly within that framework. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fact that the story references Christmas is one thing, but there's a much larger message to the story of the opera.
Yes. And so was this just kind of a no-brainer as far as an opera, this would be the one that would be done?
Well, in terms of commemorating World War One, this was the one to do. I'll come back to that in 1 second. I just have to tell you that when you produce opera, particularly an enormously large opera like this with so much technology involved in it, it's never a no-brainer.
Oh.
Because it's an extremely expensive undertaking, and we had to do quite a bit of homework. And I think at our very first meeting, I said I wasn't really sure that I could commit to doing it because the budget for this opera was way above what we normally spend.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not a no-brainer. But the sort of synchronicity of the timing of the thing, the work was premiered, the worldwide premiere was in 2011,
uh-huh.
and it was commissioned by the Minnesota Opera. In 2012, the work won the Pulitzer Prize. And I've seen the work 3 times. It is a tremendously affecting and spiritual work. Every performer who is in it talks about the magic of the piece and how it affects them. And from that point of view, it was a no-brainer. I mean, it's written by one of the foremost composer librettist teams in the country. It's absolutely beautiful. And, you know, I know of no other opera that treats the subject matter in this way. So it was a wonderful choice.
And, well, let's go ahead here and talk about one thing. I think Laura had mentioned this, because she did a wonderful overview of the collaboration for us. But the panel on Friday night, Silent Night Artists, the Silent Night Artist Panel, The Making of the Opera, The Writing of the Book. Can you tell us a little bit about who will be there and what you'll be discussing?
Absolutely. So the panel will be moderated by me and by my colleague, Dr. Matt Naylor, at the World War One Museum. And the participating panelists are Stanley Weintraub, who wrote the book Silent Night, and then the composer Kevin Putz and the librettist Mark Campbell, who have written the opera. So just to be clear, the opera Silent Night is not based on Stanley's book Silent Night.
Mm-hmm.
It is based on the movie Joyeux Noël, which was just most recently screened on Sunday and at the World War One Museum. And so that was their point of inspiration. But in the panel, we are going to talk about the process, how you take factual or non-factual information and how you create a larger impression through the different mediums. You know, I will be asking questions such as, why do you write an opera about this? You've got a movie. What does opera bring? What does the medium of opera bring to illuminate the story in a different and equally, if not more powerful way?
And I actually wanted to ask you that question. If someone hasn't gone to an opera before, what would you tell them as about opera as a storytelling vehicle? What makes it different?
Okay, well, in specific, everybody's going to have to come to the panel to hear what the speakers
yeah.
say about
yeah.
that. In general, I would say that opera is a multidisciplinary art form. So our senses get to intake a number of different things. You've got oral, as in A-U-R-A-L, oral. Mm-hmm. You've got visual. You've got singing and theater. And you've got orchestral musicians. You've got symphonic music in service to opera. And so you are bombarded through a variety of senses. And what it allows you to do is to slow down. The forms of opera generally are you tell a story and, you know, through text over music, but you also sing more lyrical passages which allow the person to enter an emotional world and describe their particular state in greater detail. So, you know, with the earlier operas, we see that more clearly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's something called an aria in which the person
yes.
who's singing explores their emotional state. The plot line is actually advanced through something we call recitative. As opera history progresses, we see a different take on those rules, but generally you still deal with 2 things. You deal with the advancement of the plot, but then what we bring to it through opera is the ability to dramatize emotional states through a vocal line, through orchestral music, and through the other elements which create opera. So it's heightened. We have an ability to heighten an emotional state through a variety of senses.
So tell us a little bit about this specific production of the opera, some of the characters.
Okay.
And who's playing them?
Of course, if you've seen Joyeux Noël, yeah, it follows it very closely. But you've got the stories of the people of three different armies and their internal struggles and their ambivalence about war and their expectation that it's going to be a war of only a few days, which we all know doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And we have people whose lives are interrupted by the war, some who are anxious to go to war, some who do not want to go to war. So you have a French Lieutenant Audebert who leaves his pregnant wife Madeleine, and he's not happy about it, and she's not happy about it. And his father is a general, and he's all military all the time. And I don't know that he quite understands his son's emotional ambivalences about what are going on. Uh-huh. You have a Scottish army. And you have Father Palmer, and then you have two brothers, and they're dying to go to war, and that's his own story. And then you have the German army, and you have the lieutenant in the German army, and then you have a person in the army who has been a tenor. And as the opera opens, he and his soprano beloved are performing on stage. They're performing partners as well as love partners. Their performance is stopped. That's how the opera begins. The performance is stopped with the arrival of a German officer who comes in and says, "We are at war. We must stop this immediately." And he is conscripted to go to war. He's not happy about that. And she's not happy about it. So we begin with the interplay among the three groups of people. What we come to is a place where each of the three armies is beleaguered and is tired, and it's Christmas. And they stumble into an opportunity where they get to know the other armies. They declare a truce, and they get to know each other. And that, of course, is the overriding message of this piece, that it is impossible to fight someone who you know is a human being. And so it's a very strong message. And interestingly enough, or not, their superiors don't really care for that point of view.
so that continues, the different feelings about war continue right from the fact of someone being conscripted to fight all the way up to the truce itself.
Right, and then the aftermath of the truce, in which they're basically all punished. They're all punished. They're all punished. They're all sent off to other places. And, of course, well, I'm not going to give it away.
Yeah.
I'm stopping now.
Now, you had one thing. This is a multilingual opera, is that correct?
Yes, because you have the different armies. So the French army sings in French, and the German army sings in German. And you think I'm going to say that the Scottish army speaks in English, but they speak in Scottish. They have blue eyes, one green and one blue. So, and of course, just in case anybody's worried, the Kaufman Center, the Muriel Kaufman Theater, has that wonderful Figaro system where there are simultaneous translations in English of what's being sung on the stage. So that should never be a reason for somebody not to come to the opera. The text is right in front of you in translation.
All right. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back in just a moment.
Hey, I'm Casey Rausch.
And I'm Mikal Shapiro. Sunday, February 22nd, 90.1 FM will be airing our show, River Trade Radio, as well as Fool Killer Folk, live from the Folk Alliance Music Fair at the Sheridan Hotel at Crown Center.
Come be a part of our real live audience or listen in online at kkfi.org. That's Sunday, February 22nd, from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m.
All aboard! River Trade Radio.
The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's speech on America's chief moral dilemma from May of 1967 on the Thursday night special at 7 p.m. right after the Heartland Labor Forum.
Welcome back to Art Speak Radio. I'm Michelle Pond, and my guest this segment is Deborah Sandler from the Lyric Opera. You mentioned that that this opera was quickly entered into the opera repertoire. Can you? Why do you think that was so?
I think it's a phenomenal piece. I think that you know, a lot of operas have been written from about 2000 to now, 2015, and more operas have been written from 2000 to now than perhaps in the 40 years preceding altogether. So there is a resurgence of opera composition. People are hungry to hear new operas. Not all people, but a lot of people. And many of them have one performance, have two performances, and that's it. But this has been remarkable because this is a work, as I said, that premiered in 2011, and then it went on to be performed in Philadelphia, Fort Worth, Cincinnati. We're the fifth American company. It was in Calgary. And then just this past October, the European premiere took place in Wexford, which I'm very happy to say I got to see as well.
Wow.
So I've seen it three times. But it is in a very accessible, romantic language. It is a beautifully crafted, beautifully, beautifully crafted piece. The conductor said to me the other day, having conducted it once before this summer in Cincinnati, that the more he does it, the more he understands the compositional complexities, but it doesn't sound that way. It just pulls you in. So I think it's a fabulous opera, and everybody wants to do it. I mean, when I saw it in Wexford, at the end of the conclusion of the show, there was 3 minutes of silence, which is an eternity.
Wow.
Everybody was just still. No one moved. It was such an affecting show. And then the audience erupted. And it will be here. It will be here this way as well. It's just, we're all speechless at the end of it. And that is a story beautifully told and sung. That is a master composer and librettist who can take you on that emotional journey and have you arrive someplace. That's masterful storytelling.
And if people want more information about the program Friday night, what's the website that they go to?
www.kcopera.org.
Okay. And that, so what are your thoughts on the collaboration? And I'm sure you've been hearing... we talked about some of the great cross marketing that's been done. So, you know, what are your feelings
I think it's been wonderful. For me, coming to town, it was really wonderful because it, you know, sort of was a quick immersion into the arts world. And I hope it's the beginning of many future such collaborations. I hope that we can do more and collaborate more. And, you know, it's been wonderful for us. There have been some unexpected surprises, things that have popped out that even we didn't foresee. But we've done a lot of things together, and it's really exciting. I want to do more.
And, yeah, why do you obviously this seems to be an emphasis with you or and something that you enjoy doing. You've done it in your other positions. What is so – why is it so important? Because it is important.
Well, I'm sort of an opera warrior. You know, I'm a zealot. I want to convert people to opera. And in order to do that, I think we have to create a point of entry. Many people are intimidated by opera. They don't understand it. They feel they haven't studied it. And so I look for common languages. I look for intersections between what people know and opera. And that's what I try to create. And I think that in order for opera to survive in the community, we need to be really – this is an old word from that last century of ours. Opera needs to be relevant. And you have to point out the relevancies. People don't get them, so we have to connect the dots. So we go out to the community to try to figure out who we can partner with, who we can talk to, who we can bring in from another circle to intersect with ours and create those connections.
And so why don't you tell us a little bit, just in general, about Lyric Opera, your season?
Well, be happy to. This we just announced next season, but we are concluding this season. We have one more show to do after Silent Night. This has really been the focal point of our season in many ways. After we finish this show on March 1st, we will then be doing some other things, and our next full production will be at Tosca. And then next season, which we have just announced, we will be doing a Don Giovanni. And as an example, we're going to do, it's a film noir version of Don Giovanni. So what did we do? A sample. So we're doing a film festival at the Tivoli Theater called Film Fatale, and it will be a film noir festival. So that's an intersection. I had a great meeting today. Then we're doing Rusalka, which will be, it's the first Czech opera we've done by Dvorak. That will be a really different, exciting show. Then we're going to do The Elixir of Love, and we're going to finish with Carmen. But we are creating community engagement events around each of these operas that will bring new people to us. And we just had a big meeting about it today. So more will be revealed. Something for everyone.
And what is your season in general, time period-wise?
We do on the main stage, which means in the Kauffman Theater at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts, we do four productions. Generally, they're late September and early November, and then we'll do one February, March, and in April. So we'll do four main shows on there. But we have a wide range of other activities, education events. We do a lot of things over in our Lyra Opera Center, and we invite the community in. We do First Friday events. So we have a whole range of different programming that we do. We do education events through our Lyric Opera Guild, and we are going to be expanding on those as well. So we're going to really be shaking it up. more opera.
And personally, what do you feel you've taken away from this collaboration with the World War I Museum?
I think that convening the group a couple of years ago to start to consider this has clearly focused and created more depth around the concept, and we've all thought about it. You know, we've considered the issues in a deeper way because we were asked to focus on it. You know, one of the things that we have given birth to is a veterans course. And that would never have come without this collaboration. And the veterans chorus is made up of veterans who like to sing and singers who like veterans. And, you know, that's done by one of our choristers, Richard Gibson. And he is a veteran, and he pulled together this chorus, and they've sung at the World War I Museum, and they've sung for us. And they're a remarkable community asset. So it's been a growth opportunity and a chance to explore a topic that we maybe not have focused on without the convening of this collaboration.
That's fabulous. Deborah, thank you. Laura, I'm going to have you do one more commercial for the online exhibit about Christmas of 1914.
Absolutely. If you go to www.theworldwar.org, you can find the historic artifacts and images and the true events that inspired the art that Kansas Cityans will be seeing on Saturday and in the four performances by the Lyric Opera. It is a great way to get your grounding in history before you go and enjoy the beauty of the art.
And I would just like to thank all of you so much for coming here tonight. Laura Vogt from the National World War I Museum, Jan Schall from the Nelson Atkins Museum, and Deborah Sandler from the Lyric Opera. Thank you so much, and we'll be watching the continuing celebration of the centennial for a few years, and some of the different collaborations that are still coming up. Jan, the exhibit goes through July 19th, and Laura, they can go to theworldwar.org to see a full calendar of events and programming at the World War I Museum. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
end.
Which one?
And I've got some calendar events. Maria, do you have some?
Well, I just want to mention that next week, the Writer's Place, staff from the Writer's Place are going to join us here on Art Speak Radio. We've got the president, Jose Faust, Rihanna Ross, and a number of people from the Writer's Place who are going to talk about their educational programs and their outreach, upcoming reading events, book signings, and that sort of thing. So you can look forward to that at the same time. It's 6 to 7:30 next Wednesday.
And tomorrow, Art in the Loop has information session noon to 1 p.m. presented by the Art in the Loop Foundation at 1000 Walnut, Suite 200. It's a call for artists to engage the downtown Kansas City community through a series of art installations and performances. And you can get more information at artintheloop.com. On Friday, February 20th, Kansas City Voices has their annual Meet the Staff event at the Uptown Arts Bar, 3611 Broadway. More information at wppress.org. And Saturday, the 21st, Kansas City Artists Coalition has an auction at 2001 Wyandotte. And more information about that at kansascityartistscoalition.org.
Hey, Michelle, I bet you didn't know that I used to sing opera. Not very well.
I didn't know
that. You know, I sing really wonderful in the shower.
Yeah.
So I'm told.
Great acoustics. Great acoustics
absolutely.
In there, right?
Absolutely. I want to remind our listeners that we have a special event this evening. Following Art Speak Radio, we're going to listen to American Roots, and then we're going to go live to the Folk Alliance Music Fair in conference down at the Westin. The Sheraton Crown Center. So we will have that coming up at 8 o'clock. And so I think we're going to have that up until from ARC to Microchip. So stay tuned for that.
Once again, I would like to thank my guests, Laura Vogt, Jan Schall, and Deborah Sandler. And this is Michelle Pond. Thanks for listening to Art Speak Radio.